Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky, and I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. I would now like to introduce this morning's speakers, Pam Murchison and Lawrence Lowe. Pamela Murchison moved to our area in June of 2019 to become the executive director of Symphoria. She spent 12 years as a member of the West Virginia Symphony Orchestra performing in the flute section, and also served as the vice president of development for her last 5 years. As both a musician and an arts administrator, Pam feels fortunate to have made the two things she loves, music and connecting people, into a profession. Lawrence Lowe was named music director of Symphoria in 2015. He also serves as the music director of the West Virginia Symphony Orchestra and previously held major conducting positions with the Pittsburgh Symphony, Northeastern Pennsylvania Philharmonic, Syracuse Opera, Pittsburgh Youth Symphony, Dallas Symphony, and the Colorado Symphony. Please join me in welcoming Pam and Larry.
It's so great to be here with everybody this morning, certainly to have the opportunity to connect with the community. And we're at Symphoria, we're just so pleased that over the past 8 seasons, including this year, we've been able to really focus on our mission to engage and inspire community members with outstanding musical performances. And we have a vision to really provide access to great music to everybody in the community. Music in and of itself has transformative power. It's a common ground. Everybody is musical, even if they're not a musician. Babies sing before they talk. And we also think that music can be a really great entry point for communities coming together. So what we really love best is to plan really great, exciting, inspiring musical programs and do that through an attitude of service so that we're really using our stage and our venues to build bridges and connections throughout the entire community. And it's really great to see, to flip through the thumbnails and see so many partners on this call this morning. Many of us have worked together or are in the early stages of planning some really exciting projects as we look to the future. And before I turn it over to Larry, I just wanted to thank Emily for having us, and also Laura Mosby, who is a Symphoria staff member. She's on the call, and she joined us in August as a community engagement manager through support from the Regional Economic Development Council. And also our board member, Vicki Feldman, is on the call with us this morning. So as you'll see as we go through this presentation, Symphoria is definitely a team sport. Some of us are more athletic than others, but we all get the the benefits of working collaboratively and transparently and openly, and it's really helped us to be very creative and resilient. The room is much smarter than any one person in it, and that has been a definite advantage for us as an organization, especially over the past 11 and a half months. the most exciting thing we do is the music and the art. So I will turn it over to our wonderful music director and a very, very good friend of mine, Larry Lowe. We've worked together for a long time. And he really inspired my family to make Syracuse their home. And I'm so glad that we did. So I'll turn it over to Larry.
Thanks, Pam. Good morning, everyone. As Pam said, we work together, and as you could tell from our bio, we worked together as musicians before, at the same time as when I was getting to know her as an arts administrator, and we're so lucky to have Pam on board here in Syracuse. So almost a year ago, I remember stepping off the podium with my colleagues in the orchestra here, and soloist Will Hagen, who had just played the Paganini First Violin Concerto with the orchestra at Cross Hines. And we were hearing about just the acceleration of worry about what was happening with the virus. And then he flew off to Paris, and then everything shut down, and we were texting. I remember just the uncertainty. in the whole world about what was happening, but especially in the arts world and with orchestras, because we were in an art form that really required a lot of people to be in the same place at the same time, and to do what we do. And so as many orchestras throughout this pandemic have ceased operations or just completely put everything on hold, Symphoria being what it is, as the slide says so perfectly, uses creativity, resilience, and transparency to keep the music playing. And it was really due to the flexibility of the orchestra and the orchestra's nature as a cooperative organization to think on its feet and to create solutions on how to move forward. And one of the first things that we did was create ways for us to work together, to be able to play together in a way that was safe. The setup that you see on that slide was developed collaboratively, first by the use of the space Inspiration Hall by the Feng family, which was donated to us. Mike Feng is a board member of Symphoria and helped us by expanding the space, using the cameras and creating more camera angles for us to be able to live stream and also pre-record new performances. That even that little lip that you see where I'm standing that extends further allows for additional musicians on the stage, because then everyone can still be 6 feet apart and separated by these dividers, which were actually made by us, by our wonderful crew and operations team. They are completely unique. Other orchestras have actually asked for the designs of what we created there, because what we're using is not plexiglass, but it's this marine vinyl that is transparent, but at the same time allows some more sound to come through than typical plexiglass. That little white machine there that you see in front of the podium, those are scattered around the stage, and they are air mitigation devices that we turn on anytime the orchestra is on break. We can't have them on while we're playing because it's like a very extreme white noise, but it aggressively mitigates the air during the breaks. And then the screen above the orchestra is what we see during the breaks, what the audience sees in terms of pre-recorded interviews or screen angles and stills. So this is all created in-house, which is why it's just so remarkable that Symphoria being comprised of people who grew up wanting to be musicians, studied to be musicians, and then decided to also accumulate life skills that allowed us to be able to just create air mitigation devices and air, using marine vinyl to create dividers. All of that comes from, just being a very creative person and the sort of person that wants to play in an orchestra like Symphoria. Another thing that we did early on before we were able to create all of that is to create videos that we sent out on our Facebook page, which became very, very active. And these were videos that we continue to make now, but were most of what we did during the first summer, late spring and summer after the shutdown. And it was a way to stay in communication with our audience, let them know that we're still here. And this is a good example of that sort of video, which is something that was created very recently for Valentine's Day, collaboratively with musicians and staff of Symphoria.
So that was something that was produced by our clarinet section, and Alan Kolsky, the gentleman in the middle, really has been learning as he goes all of the ways to put these multi-track performances together. He spends hours making sure that everything lines up, that it sounds as good as it possibly can, because we do know that nothing competes with the experience of live music. And it really kind of leads into the next thing we'd like to talk about, which is our best asset. Alan asked all of the Symphoria family, musicians, board, and staff, a couple of people I'm sure you can recognize from that, but asked everyone to participate. And it, just like everything else that we have done this season, everyone had different levels of comfort doing it. But the fact that people want to participate in something like this, and something that just makes the community feel good, and also helps the community to see the orchestra as part of the community. The musicians are incredibly talented musicians, and they're a lot more than that too. They love the crunch. They love walking in Green Lakes. They love camping in the Adirondacks. They really love being a part of the community. And so we're just really so glad that we have people dedicated to making great music, but also dedicated to being Syracusians and Central New Yorkers. So definitely something that I've been thankful for many times a day is the people that I get to work with to do this mission, to fulfill this mission and vision. So we have 42 core musicians in the orchestra. We do have some vacancies. It's been very difficult to hold auditions this year for orchestras everywhere. So we have some opportunities to grow. In addition to Larry as our music director, we have Sean O'Loughlin, who is from Lynn Court, lives in LA, but comes back to be our principal pops conductor. 17 great board members, five of whom are also musicians in the orchestra. So we always get the opportunity to kind of explain on our grants why we have board directors that are compensated. And it's not that they're compensated at all for being shareholders or board members. It's because they're employees of the organization. The musicians are the owners. I report to the musicians, which is really unusual and can sometimes be a very vulnerable thing, but is really helped us in a lot of ways, because as we're making really difficult decisions, anytime we go into executive session, the musicians are in the room too. And so that means that we're making the decisions collaboratively, that the people it most directly affects have a huge voice in saying that. And then we also have 10 staff members, many of whom again are musicians, that we're really working as one unit. And it's been really inspiring to see people see this year as an infinite number of challenges, but really to find the opportunity in those things. We've been able to try a lot of new things and different things. As Larry mentioned, the Thing family, Francis and Betty, and then Mike, their son, and Dan, and really the whole family who have provided us a home at Inspiration Hall. It was already set up with audiovisual equipment at no cost. So we were actually, the shutdown really happened for us on March 15th. But until about 10 o'clock the night before, we were ready to live stream a concert March 16th from Inspiration Hall. And it was just that it wasn't safe for us to put that many musicians on stage with the local and national guidance. We are a union orchestra. We have an excellent relationship with Local 78 of the American Federation of Musicians. They have worked with us every step of the way to make sure that we're doing things in a way that really honors and protects the musicians and sticks with best practices in our industry. We have 130 musicians this year enrolled in our Symphoria Youth Orchestra. So they've been great to participate. They've been practicing really hard. Our musicians have been coaching them in small groups. Their parents have been trusting and helped us form our safety protocols so that they feel like it's a very good thing for their students to be involved this year when not everybody is really comfortable. Some of the kids are homeschooled because they're not ready for that, but they are coming to us. And we have many funders on this call. So thank you for sticking with us and seeing us through. But I particularly wanted to thank the Syracuse Symphony Foundation and Onondaga County as our two largest funders, and just providing us a platform we've been able to dream this year because of the support of the community. So that means that while we have been in emergency mode, we've also been thinking and dreaming and planning for tomorrow and for next year. And that's a gift because Symphoria has been able to really grow and have a very high morale during what's a really hard time. Taking care of these assets has been really important to Larry and to me as well. So we're really grateful to be able to do that. And as I said, we have some concerts ahead and we have a whole season coming up. And so I'm going to let Larry kind of talk about that a little bit. But also just we did a really fun project in December where we did like baseball cards for our musicians. So Eduardo Sepulveda is our new principal oboist. He is... been with the organization for two seasons. He is not from Central New York originally, like many of our musicians. He has made Central New York his home because of Symphoria. And just a way to kind of celebrate the musicians and the real depth of what they bring to our community. So, and all this stuff is available on our social media and YouTube and all sorts of things you can check out after. So, Larry?
Yes. So as far as our programming, we've had 26 live stream programs since last May. And we have 9 more planned before the end of the current season, the fiscal kind of season that orchestras use, which ends in May 2021. I get texts from friends who want to attend concerts who live in Texas, who live in other countries. My parents who are in the winter in Florida, they've been able to attend concerts. We have patrons from 31 states and Canada, England, Australia. And it's been absolutely amazing to see the breadth of our reach through this live streaming. We were able to have an agreement with our local union to be able to live stream beyond the local the local community that would normally be able to like drive to our concerts. And that's been great because it's helped us stay connected to people that that have gone into isolation in places that that are not here. And also the fact that no people can come to our concerts. Everything is through the internet. We have so many wonderful partnerships with local service organizations, including Northside Learning, Q Center, David's Refuge, Golisano Children's Hospital, and Syracuse VA Hospital. And it's been incredible just building that as we navigate through the pandemic. I wanted to just talk a little bit about the evolution of our programming through the pandemic, because it started off where, you know, after the immediate shutdown, it was single or double people, a couple quartets, all separated and edited together and put out through the internet. When we developed our staging setup, we were able to open our season with Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, which is a relatively full orchestra, all spread apart. I remember how disorienting that was to perform, and we could talk more about that later if people are interested, but just performing under those circumstances is completely different than you would imagine, and different in ways that I think I didn't anticipate. You know, just being spread out and being separated, and the first slide didn't show that I'm also separated by a giant like clear cubicle that's twice as high as everyone else's. So yeah, it's like that. So I really feel like I'm out in the woods, you know, like I don't feel like I have much like physical connection to anyone. And it's difficult, you know, if you're a conductor, all you want to do is, you know, you're trying to communicate with everyone through every part of your body. You're sometimes you're a subtle move in your elbow is saying something. And if you feel like you're even that further, that much more separated from everyone, it makes it, it's a very disconcerting scenario. But I feel like the orchestra and I have figured out ways to perform under those circumstances that's very effective. And if you've seen any of our concerts, which I hope you have, you could see that that it seems like we're all performing in the same way. It's just like we've had to relearn how to communicate that nonverbal communication. So we've had several concerts like that in the fall before the mandate to reduce, you know, when we got into a smaller zone or a more cautious zone, and then eventually into this orange zone where we needed to have only 10 people on the stage at one time. I think it was 10. Was it 10, Pam?
Yeah.
So I remember the one concert I did under that circumstance, because what we would do is, you know, as it would change, we had this quick action, I forget what we called it, like the rapid response team of our committee, which talks about programming, which was the bare minimum. It was like five people, musicians and me and Pam and our program annotator. And we would just make quick decisions like, okay, we're gonna do this Mendelssohn, we're gonna change that to this Beethoven, and we're gonna do, so we did a lot more chamber music during that time. And a lot of those decisions were made by a subset of the programming committee, which is much bigger, which comprises of many musicians as well, but just a larger number of them. And they just entrusted the smaller rapid response team to be able to make quick decisions as things were just changing so quickly. And there was one program that was really important to us, which was in collaboration with Syracuse University, which was a young composers program where we had, I think it was three very, very young, like high school aged and college aged composers who had written music with the faculty at Syracuse University to perform with with Symphoria. And then as soon as we knew that it was going to be a smaller group, we asked them to do with a much smaller orchestration. And then even that orchestration was too big for the group, group allowable in January when we did this reading. And so what we had to do was, I think it was written for 12 musicians, including me. And so there were two people that had to exit the stage. And so what we would do is I looked through the scores and figured out ways that we could perform most of the music the way that they did, but eliminate the musicians that weren't playing and have them actually leave the room. And then we would play through that part of the music, and then I would stop, and then I would ask the two people that were about to not play to actually leave, and then the other two come back on, and then we would continue. And then, and the whole time the composers were on a video screen next to us watching so we could see them. But there was this, you know, like funny separation, but they were there and they were able to hear everything that was happening, and they were able to suggest things, and we were able to suggest things and give feedback. And then, you know, like it was a constant musical chairs, literally, but it was such a funny way for us to navigate that challenge of, you know, adhering to the protocol, but also being able to give as much of what we wanted to these young musicians and composers. And it was a really gratifying and funny scenario that I never thought I'd be in. So thankfully, more recently, as things are beginning to open up, we started making adaptive programs. So for example, last month, or actually earlier this past February, we did a program where we decided, okay, well, we can put a fuller orchestra on the stage, but let's transition to that just in case, actually when we made this program, we thought it might open up. And so we had a string symphony by Mendelssohn that we knew could be performed only with like six or seven people. But if things opened up the way that we thought it was going to, could be expanded to a fuller orchestra. And that's what happened. And then we expanded it. And then to the last program that you saw with the Pharynx and the Mendelssohn Symphony ended up just adding strings to it because we could perform it with smaller or bigger number of musicians. And then coming up, we have a fuller orchestra, Mozart 40th Symphony, something that's requested every year that we're finally getting to do during the pandemic. and then a piano concerto by Beethoven that also used a full orchestra. So lots to look forward to as we move through the rest of the season. And one thing that we keep asking ourselves is how it will be when we move into the future in terms of the way that we're presenting programs now, with so much of this behind the scenes human contact type of material, with intermissions, with interviews, with preview videos, with pre-concert talks that are available days before the concert. And we have to ask ourselves, you know, are there people who are still going to not want to come to concerts? You know, are they still going to want to watch programs through, you know, in their pajamas and sweatpants? You know, I certainly like that. I enjoy doing that. And I don't know if other people like that too. You know, like putting the video temporarily on hold so you can take a giant bite of a taco during a concert. That might be something that people want to do. And so, you know, we have to ask ourselves, what's going to stay with us after the pandemic? And I think it's something that the whole industry is going to have to grapple with, because there are some things that have happened this last year that are things that maybe should have already been happening. Who knows? Anyway.
Well, and I just to follow up a little bit on what Larry said, you know, I think that a year ago, for me anyway, I, you know, for many people, we're a respite, you know, we're somewhere to go to kind of leave it all behind, just to sit and be present with the music. And we don't want people thinking about things like, are there enough stands on stage, or is the piano going to come out, or, oh my gosh, lid up, lid down. And, you know, what we really have observed the musicians and the staff doing is just being so gracious. I mean, for a professional musician, you know, it's really normal to know this time of the year what you're going to play all next season. And we had certainly announced that this time last year. You know, pieces we're excited about, pieces that are new, so you start working on really early, because, you know, we're athletes in training, really, trying to develop the skills and make sure that we have the stamina to do this work. It's very, very physical and mentally taxing, as it is joyful as well, but that the musicians have been willing to, you know, within a couple of weeks or days, switch to different pieces. The chamber music experience is really different than the full orchestra experience. As Larry said, playing 6 or 8 feet away from your colleagues is really different. We like to be close to each other and feel that, you know, physical body language and things like that. We have a really smart personnel manager that hires for the best case, largest scenario, and then make sure that we make decisions in enough time to release people from services if we don't need it. So it's really like this four-dimensional puzzle. And most of the time people are still laughing and like, yeah, let's do it. Okay. You know, and that's been, that was actually one of my biggest concerns in September, was when are we all going to lose it? And that, I'm sure people have had moments in private, but really it's wonderful to sneak into rehearsals and see the musicians just being really happy to work, to be with their friends and colleagues and to really make great music. And for the patrons to give us feedback that, you know, I'm waiting on this medical procedure. I'm at home alone. My husband died. I'm just living for Saturday night when Symphoria plays. And it's a real privilege to be able to do that for people. You know, one of the things that we've also been focusing on this season is, and really for the past several years, is being really responsive to our community. The orchestra industry absolutely has a diversity issue. What we see represented on stage is not what we see represented throughout the community. And Symphoria is really committed to being a part of that. There are some really long-term kind of systemic issues that we're working on internally, some different programs and things that we're thinking about. We have a partnership with the Sphinx Organization, which is a program out of Detroit, 20 years in the making, dedicated to improving diversity on stage with orchestras, musicians of color within the orchestra, composers of color, guest artists of color. And we actually all attended a keynote presentation by their founder, Aaron Dworkin, last night. And it was really great. He played a musical example with a young soloist, Hannah White. And as coincidence would have it, Hannah's going to come and play with the orchestra in April. And so we're really humbled by knowing that we're not there yet. We're not. We are working very hard to be better and be ever better representative of the community and world in which we live. But we also are really proud that 75% of our concerts this season have featured performers or composers from underrepresented communities, whether that's the BIPOC community, LGBTQ, really women composers, especially of the 18th and 19th century, many of whom weren't, you know, recognized in their life, but were, you know, contemporaries of Beethoven and Mozart and Haydn. And so it's work that we feel passionate about, and we're always doing a better job, trying to do a better job of. So as Larry said, you know, there are a lot of uncertainties about next season. In fact, if you would have asked me what I thought September was going to look like at noon yesterday, I would have told you one thing. And then when the news came out about 3 o'clock about the public venues being opened and, you know, you can have 100 people in the hall, I don't know. So we're really trying to weigh the decisions. We have a patron survey that's out because we know that just because we can do something doesn't mean the community will feel safe doing it. And things are changing really fast. You know, with the news that vaccines will be available to all adults by May. That's amazing. I personally am very excited about that for my family. I don't know what that means for the implementation schedule, and I don't know what that means for our patrons. I mean, our patrons do mostly fall into the most vulnerable category, and what we know is about 60% of them are excited to come back, but they don't know that they're going to be ready right in September. So what do we do to make that experience feel really great for the musicians, for the patrons? If we're putting 100 people in a space for 8,000 patrons, that's not going to feel great for anybody. And so how do we invest our resources? You know, Larry said, we have a really great team, an artistic operations committee. How do we create programming that's really responsive to the community where we are right now? And so one of the things Larry's been really great about is following what other orchestras are doing and looking at some of the pieces that have been commissioned or composed this year that are really honoring where the world is in a way that is respectful of really the mourning and the trauma we've been going through as a community, but also hopeful about the future and uplifting. And so we're looking forward to that. And Larry, I don't know if you want to say anything about some pieces or things that we're looking to do next season.
Sure. Well, yeah, I mean, I can, one thing I was thinking about when you were talking about the diversity in our programming, Symphoria has always been ahead of the curve in terms of, I guess, the industry average of recognizing the fact that that our art form is extremely not diverse. I mean, just like typically, and Symphoria has always been concerned about that. But I think this past year has really accelerated that for the industry and for Symphoria in particular. I got invited to conduct a concert. It was in Dallas, Texas with Dallas Symphony and Orchestra that I've conducted for many years because I was a part of that orchestra as associate conductor earlier in my career. And Texas, which just lifted its mask mandate and everything's open 100%. It's kind of the Wild West in terms of how orchestras are functioning, because every orchestra has, like, they can do anything. You know, they can do full concerts if they want with no masking, no distancing. So it's on the orchestras themselves to have some sort of rule about how to keep everyone safe. And Dallas has really been absolutely amazingly just kind of aggressively safe. Everyone is COVID tested every single day. And when I went there for this concert, which was a concert in response to racial violence, it was a unity concert in response to racial violence. And there was an audience there. It was also live streamed. So it was very bizarre. It was one of the only concerts I've done this year for people in the hall. And so for that reason, it really kind of stands out in my mind. But there was one piece that I conducted there which was written by a 25-year-old composer named Quinn Mason, a young Black composer, grew up in Dallas, and is now, you know, writing music for all the, you know, like biggest orchestras around the world. He got commissioned to write a piece for this concert that was, like the Mendelssohn, able to be played by a very small group of string players, but could be expanded to a full string orchestra. And it's called a Reflection on a Memorial. And he wrote it after the tragedy, tragic death of George Floyd. And it's a piece that we want to perform next season as a part of our, like as a featured piece on one of our main programs. And we're just trying to find the right spot for that particular piece. But there's lots of pieces like that that we have discovered through this year that's just kind of been eye-opening. We're so proud to make these kinds of connections when I conduct other orchestras and bring those ideas and that music to Syracuse. So that's one example of one of the pieces that I literally ran into this year that is going to be a featured work next season. I look forward to all of you, if you go to that concert, in hearing it.
We're doing it in April. April just feels like
next season. Is that one in April? Okay, because at one point we were going to move it to next season, but that one is April.
And it probably changed since we started. So yeah.
Whenever we do it, yeah. Pam, the whole time is probably like biting your tongue, but it's in April.
No, I'm like, it's just been like that. But, you know, we're like this behind the scenes too.
This shows how much we're juggling, you know, behind the scenes, because there are pieces that we were supposed to do this year that we're doing next year. And there are pieces that we were going to do this past January that we moved to later in the season. But I thought we'd move that one to next year. But we haven't.
Not yet. It's only 8:30.
See, that's the piece. That's the kind of piece, though, that could be performed during the most extreme part of the lockdown, because, as I said, you know, you can do it on one and apart. But, So tune in April to hear that one.
Well, and as somebody asked me a couple of weeks ago, they said, you know, has there been another time that orchestras have had to adapt like this? And I sort of thought about it for a while. And, you know, Emily and I were talking about earlier this morning about like the effects of the Industrial Revolution. That's when the grand piano as we know it was formed. It's when brass instruments got piston valves, which means they could be a lot more virtuosic. And that technological development during the Industrial Revolution absolutely impacted what orchestras do. So I see the past year, what all of the performing arts organizations, our colleagues at Red House and Syracuse Stage, Onondaga Historical Association, the Everson, I could go on and on. So my apologies for anyone I didn't mention. But what we've seen is people just really adapt to where we are and use this time to use music or theater or spoken word to really reflect what's going on right now. And the performing arts have always done that. They've been a mirror. And so, working with Larry and the artistic planning for today and next month and moving forward, and it has been zany for sure. Just making sure that we really are, pun intended, not being tone deaf to where we are as a community right now and as a world. Moving forward to what the financial outlook is, because I know that's always top of my mind. No mission, no margin, no mission, for sure. Our current position's really strong. The people of the organization, our board members, our unofficial partners, our auditor have been really helpful in establishing, walking through the Paycheck Protection Program. We've received two grants. We've been very fortunate that we have generous donors, and we've had two major estate gifts sadly come to fruition this year, but I hope those two women are really smiling down and seeing what they've helped us accomplish and help us plan for the future. Our year-to-date income is down mostly through earned ticket revenue. People have been buying tickets to concerts, but it's not the same as being together in person. We have about 300 IP addresses tuning in to each concert. We multiply that by two or three to figure we've got about 600 or 800 people watching. But the tickets are less expensive for the patrons. It's not the same experience as being in the hall. And, you know, our costs are down too, hugely because of the FANGs and also because of the musicians kind of, we've kept the maintained salaries and benefits. No one's been furloughed or laid off. There have been no reduction in weeks, no reduction in salary. But some of the extra things like the media payments that would normally accompany a live stream performance, because if the company is going to take in more revenue, then the musicians should get a share of that. But understanding this is a very odd time, the musicians have worked with us so that we're not responsible for those things right now during the pandemic. So, you know, the challenge is really a kind of understanding a lot of these revenue results are not renewable. They're not sustainable. We don't want to have really huge estate gifts come to fruition every year for obvious reasons. We want our patrons to be with us and enjoying the impact of their gifts. And, you know, certainly the federal funding, we're not anticipating continuing to the same level moving forward. So just trying to get information from the data, from the patrons themselves, working with our partners at the On Center at St. Paul's Church to understand what the requirements are going to be, what the costs are going to be for us as an organization in terms of having more security, having more paid ushers and greeters on hand so that we can verify vaccination reports and testing reports, understanding if the patrons are going to want to go through those testing protocols just to come to a concert. You know, we just don't know. And so we're being really cautiously optimistic, taking little small, the Jim Collins idea of shooting bullets rather than cannonballs right at the beginning, just making small steps forward. Stage said it very beautifully in a social media post yesterday, like it's really exciting that we can reopen, but it does take time. It takes time for us to understand and make sure that we're really responsibly using your resources, the financial resources you've provided, so that we can keep going, beyond the reopening and kind of ease our way back safely and in a way that feels good into not back to normal, but the new normal, because we're never going back. We're never going to be a pre-COVID orchestra again. And so we want to really honor that in our decisions. So, you know, we showed you a video of our clarinet section. If you want to see the full orchestra, you'll have to join us for a online concert coming up. And I know many of you have. So all of the information really is at experienceinforia.org. You can check out the most up-to-date information there. And we really want to leave some time. We could talk forever, obviously, but we have a few minutes for questions and really want to hear from you and answer anything we haven't addressed so far.
Great, thank you so much. So first question for you, have you considered a model like the Green Bay Packers where the community can invest in Symphoria?
I don't know this model.
It's basically the community kind of invests and they kind of own part of the Packers, the community can kind of buy into the team and they own part of it.
Oh, I would say-
like an expanded co-op, I guess, okay.
I would say that is the model that we have. I mean, we recognize that, you know, while the community can't have a great orchestra without our musicians, we certainly can't have the musicians here without the community. So that's kind of the way I really do think about what we're doing. We are always asking people, listening to people, talking to people, creating new partnerships so that we can understand what the community wants, and then ask the community to invest those resources in a way that we can execute those programs. And I know, Larry, I'm not sure if you want to respond to that too from the artistic side of things.
Well, I was just going to say that what, you know, the model of the orchestra right now is that it's owned by the musicians, which is different from the way that orchestras normally are formed. You know, the usually orchestras are their own entity and hire musicians to be a part of the orchestra. And so I think that makes it, you know, that makes us quite different from an ordinary, especially American orchestra. There are only two and a half orchestras in the US that are owned by musicians. And, you know, we don't have to go through the whole history, but obviously after the bankruptcy of the Syracuse Symphony, and this new orchestra was formed by the musicians, they hired me. They first hired Sean, and then they hired as principal pops conductor, and then they hired me as music director. And then a couple years ago, we hired Pam as the new executive director. You know, we all were brought in by the musicians. So the musicians themselves are kind of, you know, this is a question I actually ask the musicians themselves, because they are the ones who own the orchestra. But I think that ownership has given them just obvious, you know, investment in the orchestra in a way that I think is unusual. You know, when you see musicians putting stands away and chairs away after a concert because they just want to help, you know, that's the sort of thing that you don't see in other orchestras. That's not the way that orchestra musicians usually are, I guess, like they don't see their role in that way in a typical orchestra. So that makes us very different. But it's an interesting question. You know, anything to, you know, to help kind of build the orchestra and make it a part of the community is a good thing. So, you know, it's funny, Pam and I both didn't know about this, the Green Bay Packers. I'm a Steelers person. I probably shouldn't say that. I don't know.
We won't hold that against you. We've got a couple folks want to know about plans for outdoor summer concerts.
We're hard at work at that. So we typically do 7 concerts throughout the region, one in Syracuse, Fayetteville, the Village of Hamilton, Skaney Atlas, Auburn, Oswego, and Rome. And, you know, a couple of people have let us know that they're just not ready. They know today that no. It's not going to happen, but some people are saying, we don't know. And we're working with locally to kind of figure out what our plans are. So, you know, the news yesterday that if an event is registered with the county health department, it could have 500 people outside. That changes things even from, you know, 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon. So we're working on it. And the musicians are really, really, really excited to play for humans. I mean, knowing people are watching has been really great, and we're so thankful, and we want to get together with all of you as soon as it's safe.
Great, thank you. Next question, is there still a youth orchestra?
Yes, the youth orchestra, there was the Syracuse Youth Symphony Orchestra in the past, which was affiliated with the Syracuse Symphony, and then during a certain amount of time, well, during after the bankruptcy, Syracuse University generously took the youth orchestra under their wings. And for a number of years, even after Symphoria's existence, the youth orchestra continued as a collaborative organization with Symphoria and Syracuse University. And then Symphoria, then in the last maybe 2 years or so, maybe 3 years, has taken the youth orchestra back under its wing, kind of rebranded it so that, you know, it's really obvious who is completely running it, which is Symphoria. Coaches are all Symphoria musicians. The conductors are affiliated with Symphoria in some way. And my son actually plays in Symphoria Youth Orchestra. He's a senior in high school right now. This year has been, you know, the last 12 months have been very different than normal, when they would just get together at OCC and rehearse as a big group. But now they're doing the small groups, and he still goes off to rehearsal, but it's just with a smaller group of musicians and a Symphoria coach. So they're still getting a lot of great experiences, probably some of the most memorable experiences, just, you know, everyone's going to remember what happened during this time. And hopefully this will be something that's very positive.
So can you talk a little bit about more about collaborations that you've had with other arts organizations in the area? We have so many great ones. I'm sure you have some great partnerships there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one, like, for example, when we do our Spark concerts, that is an extremely collaborative type of concert. In the past, you know, we would do them at different venues. Right now we do them all, you know, live streamed from Inspiration Hall, but we would do like Red House. We would do a Halloween concert there. We would work with Circle Ovation, which we just did a program with them, but we would do it live where that arts organization would, you know, be doing their juggling and their acrobatics while we perform behind them. There's so many ways that we can collaborate in that way. Syracuse University, Syracuse Stage, we did a program based on Amadeus when they were performing that. And we would do an all Mozart Salieri type of concert, and it was linked to that production. Anytime that we can find a way to work with our partners, I think is a good thing. And Symphoria is really nimble, you know, so we can figure out a way to make anything happen in terms of just like out of the box thinking. And so I remember doing like one of my early concerts in the Spark series was at the Most, and that was just amazing because we did work with Circle Ovation with that, but we also would perform in different parts of the museum. You know, we would have a quartet during, you know, during a break over in one area, and then everyone would kind of just walk around the space, and maybe for a lot of them it was like a Symphoria patron going to the Most for the first time, who knows. And they would just go around to the different stations and experience different things, take it in with, you know, the thing that they know about, which maybe was the music, and then learn about other things that was that are happening at the Most, and so those sorts of programs happen all the time with us.
Well, and also we, I know Greg Tripoli was on the call this morning, and we've worked with his team at the Onondaga Historical Association. Syracuse has a very rich history in a lot of different ways. And so we did a Frank Sinatra concert in October, and he brought over some of the Jimmy Van Heusen, you know, wrote Come Fly With Me. So we had like the original movie posters. Our last in-person concert that Larry referenced was all Italian. So all Italian composers. So Greg generously lent us the panels from an Italian exhibit that the OHA had done. And so we had those on display in the lobby, and it was just really fun. I think when you, it's I think easy for Larry and me being new here to see how great the community is. And I think that you're all here this morning because you understand what a great community we live in. But it can be hard to see your hometown as like really awesome sometimes. I know I've experienced that in my hometown. And sometimes you have to kind of go away to see that. But I think that those kinds of opportunities help people just, you see people walk by and they like kind of stand up a little straighter. Oh, I forgot that. Or, oh, that's where we used to go. Or my mom loved that bakery. And it really just is a nice way to enhance the experience and to work with a great partner like Greg and to really celebrate our community and what the community's been able to build. So, we're very fortunate. We've got great, great partners.
Great. Thank you. So besides buying tickets to concerts, how else can community members support Symphoria and all the amazing things that you're doing?
Well, we make it very easy to donate on our website. We certainly are we're a nonprofit, so we a lot of what's helped us through, especially this season, is contributed income and donations and, you know, really gifts of all level. People give sacrificially at $50 or more, $5. We love to see the community step up and really invest in the work that we're doing, because we couldn't do it without you. Right now, we are actually having our Symphoria raffle, which is to support our education and outreach programs that Laura, who's been in the chat, has been so great in developing. And this is something that really grew out of a partnership with our friend Bob Oddy, if you know his wonderful stained glass art. For several years, he's donated a brand new piece. And there are photos of what he's creating this year on our website and on his Facebook page. He's doing sort of a behind the scenes work in progress. And there are actually a bunch of prizes, including a large cash prize and other experiences that the musicians are donating. We've got a new certified yoga instructor in the flute section. So you can do like a Zoom yoga lesson, conducting lessons with Larry, no previous experience required, arranging lessons with Sean O'Loughlin, our Pops conductor. So the information for that is at experienceinforia.com. If you go to buy, you can click down to raffle. And telling your friends. It's one thing for Larry or myself to invite people to the orchestra, but Harvey, when you invite your friends or your family to, I love this orchestra is so great, come and join me. That just really matters. So we try and do really large scale strategic marketing, but also grassroots marketing. We're a family, we're a team, we're a community. And you know, we're a place where we want the community to feel like you belong and it's your orchestra. Larry and I are stewards of it. It's this community's orchestra. And so you help us build that community.
That's very beautifully put. So unfortunately we are out of time. So thank you very much everyone for coming and listening to the presentation today and interacting through the chat. So please join me in thanking Pam and Larry. Thanks everyone. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.